The last time we were in verse 5, we were talking about the contrast between the person in verse 4 who seeks to be justified by the law and finds himself a distance from grace, which is a relatively horrible kind of situation to be in. But the alternative is verse 5, that those who by faith are willing to wait for the hope of righteousness through the Spirit, that's a different approach altogether. And his final statement for this paragraph is verse 6. So we've come to the end of the information in verses 2 through 6, if we take verse 1 of chapter 5 as kind of a thesis, standalone kind of statement, where he exhorts us to be sure that we're clear on the issue of our freedom, and then explaining the contrast between those who depend on themselves and those who by faith wait for God to fulfill his commitments. In verse 6, he concludes his argument in the context by saying, in Christ Jesus, neither circumcision nor uncircumcision means anything. We could even add, the only thing that really means anything is faith working through love. So as we come to the end of this first paragraph in the third section of Galatians, we look at this statement that Paul in effect says, faith is at the top of the heap of things that are supposed to address what's wrong with the world. Faith working through love. Nothing else means anything. At first blush, that kind of looks a little different than 1 Corinthians 13, where faith, hope, and love abide, and love is the greatest. Love's in this verse at the end of it, but his focus is on faith. That's the thing that makes the difference. I just want to make this comment about the word circumcision and uncircumcision in a sense. Those are single word summaries of entire concepts. In other words, when Paul was trying to address the entire problem of legalism, he just put it all under one word, circumcision. When he was looking at a way to summarize the libertinism of the Gentiles, he just summarized it under one word, uncircumcision. He's not just talking about the physical action of circumcision or the lack thereof. He's talking about the entire systems that drive those two issues. So when he talks about faith working through love, again, he's talking about a very summary statement, because there are many, 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 many things that need to be believed. And all of those things that need to be believed need to be energized by love. But the principle is faith energized by love. So Paul's not contradicting his concept in 1 Corinthians 13. We've said it this way many times. Love is at the root of everything, because love is the agenda setter. Faith is the application of a methodology for the accomplishment of the agenda. So love says this is what's important. Faith says, how can I get there from here? And a method is pops in into place. And you say, okay, I'll apply that to chase this. And faith in the scriptures is always a relatively passive thing of depending on God to operate according to what he's said. Now, what we want to be clear on is the fact that the book of Galatians as an entire letter is really all about methodology, not objective. In other words, it's about faith, not love. The book of Galatians is the fundamental New Testament book on methodology. It is not by works, but by faith. That's the big issue. And because of that, it's a methodological book, and in terms of method, it really doesn't matter what the objective is. What really matters is whether, in fact, the method will work or not. And in the New Testament record about faith and whether it works or not, Jesus made the comment, for example, that if a mountain needs to be moved and you have the faith, it will be. Even if your faith is as a grain of mustard seed. You can say to this mountain, be plucked up and cast in the sea, and splash. No cannonball dive has ever made such a big splash. Jesus' statement doesn't raise the issue of whether the mountain needed to be moved. He just said, if you had the faith, it would. Which means he's talking methodologically, not objective. He's not talking about whether it needs to be moved. He's talking about whether it can be moved and the method of faith in doing it. Paul, however, does in our text address whether faith will actually work, and that's what we're going to be looking at this evening. If circumcision doesn't work and uncircumcision doesn't work, if neither one of them, quote, mean anything, and that's really not a very good translation, if they don't mean anything, however that, and I'll talk about that in a little bit, then what does mean something is faith. That does work because it's energized through love. I'd like to start off our thinking about this verse and its statements by thinking about Paul's focus in the text, because it's all about accomplishment. In all of Paul's methodology statements in the verse, circumcision as a methodology, uncircumcision as a methodology, faith as a methodology, in all three of these methodology statements, there is an objective in view. The concept of circumcision as a one-word summary of an entire system has a premier system-high or system-wide concept that's at the top of it. Why does anybody buy into the entire system for which circumcision stands as a summary word? And the answer is, in the context of Galatians, that's how you get to be accepted by God. The same thing is raised in the second word, uncircumcision, because uncircumcision is obviously the opposite of circumcision, but it again represents an entire system of thought about how you are to be acceptable, in the Gentile terminology, to the gods. But this acceptance by God, or acceptance by the gods, also has another level. Because the question has to be asked and answered, what difference does it make if the gods accept you or if God accepts you? And the bottom line in that is, of course, that it's your life that's at stake. The quality of your experience as an exister that can't get out of it. Everybody that is going to be forever. You can't get out of the isness. That's what is means. You can't get out of it. But the quality of your experience in being is enormously broad in terms of its reach, and it makes an enormous amount of difference to every individual what the quality of their experience is while they're existing. So, circumcision says, well, I can achieve the highest level of my quality of experience if I'm accepted by God, who commanded Abraham to circumcise his family and everyone in his household, and I want to be accepted by Abraham's God so that my life can be the best it can possibly be. And the Gentiles, though they didn't know the God of Abraham or Isaac or Jacob, they had their own pantheon of gods, and they would say, much like the Jew, the real issue here is whether the quality of my experience is going to be worth a plug nickel or not. And I can't make life good myself. I need some power here. And the executors of power are the gods. And therefore, I'm going to appeal to the gods to exercise their power to give me the quality of life that I'm looking for. That's what's going on in the big picture thing. And it's still going on when we get to the faith statement. Because faith working through love is another one of those things where the context is, are you going to be acceptable to God? And what difference does that make? And the difference is always, well, it affects the quality of your experience in your being. You're going to be forever, and the quality of your experience is the fundamental issue, and that's what's held out all through the scriptures. I mean, even in Genesis, where God said to Adam, don't eat the fruit of that tree. In the day you eat of it, surely you will die. Or dying, you will die. What was God talking about? He was talking about what Adam's quality of experience was going to be if he did this or not. It's always been there. That's the big deal. Faith is a one-word summary of the alternative to the entire universe in which the circumcision and uncircumcision exist as viable methods of achieving the objective. As long as a person sees circumcision as a viable method, he's not yet come to faith. As long as a person sees uncircumcision as a viable method, he has not yet come to faith. Faith as a viable method stands outside of the entire universe of those other two options. So, it's critical that we understand what Paul is driving at in verse 6 when he says that circumcision doesn't work, uncircumcision doesn't work, faith does. He chose some particular words when he was addressing this method business. And he is talking about what the translators say in the New American Standard means anything. The King James says availeth anything, I believe. Anybody got the King James? It's availeth. Anyway, the whole idea there is whether this will produce that. That's why availeth anything. And I don't know why means anything is in here. The word is the verb iskuo. And when Paul chose to write that particular word, he had some options in mind. In the Greek language, and this is going to be a review for several of you, in the Greek language, there are three fundamental words that have to do with the application of power to the accomplishment of an objective. In secular Greek, the three were broken down in terms of military terminology. In the military terminology, the real issue is whether you're going to win or not. That's the victory. Or the defeat. And the secular word for victory was dunamis, our term for power, found in Romans 1, the gospel is the power of God. That's the word we get our word dynamite from. Everybody's heard that before. But the fact is, in the military thing, if you had the dunamis, you had the victory. The question is, how do you get the victory? And the other two words come into play. In the Greek language, there was a word for all of the military elements, the weaponry, the soldiers, the horses, elephants, whatever, the bows, the arrows, the lances, the swords, the shields, the helmets, the armor, all of that was the elements that were available to be applied to the problem of the conflict that's coming so that you could win. And if you had all of these elements available to you, there was only one thing standing between you and victory. And that middle thing was the quality of the command. In other words, the soldiers that were in charge, the sergeants and the lieutenants and the captains and the majors and the colonels and generals, these are the guys who are deciding how all of these implements of war will be assigned. And ultimately, if the person or set of persons in the military skill thing that decide that. That's how Alexander the Great was able to be such a dominant military genius, because he often attacked armies that were far larger in the elemental level and won. Because he was a strategist. He could outthink the leaders of the other army. He could use less resources to accomplish greater results, and he'd win. In another metaphor, it's the guy who has the little body with a wiry frame and a lot of discipline in the area of judo or karate or whatever, martial arts, versus the great big guy who's got lots of muscle and bone and weight and all. But those are the elements. It's the guy who organizes those elements by knowing karate as opposed to just brute force that's going to win. The victory is going to go because all three of these are involved. It's your resources, your application of the resources and wisdom to the victory. When Paul used the term neither circumcision nor uncircumcision means anything, he's talking about the elemental level. You take everything that's involved in the thought processes that result in circumcision as a concept, and those are the elements, and they will not accomplish the victory. It really doesn't matter how you organize them. They're not going to work. At the elemental level, the basic assets are not sufficient for the task. On the other alternative, uncircumcision is just like that. It's just as incapable of producing the victory as circumcision is, because the elemental resources are not enough. Let me use another illustration. We all know how our bodies are put together to some degree. We have a muscle here, and it is attached to a joint here, some bone here, and the ligaments run from this muscle from up here where it's joined down past this joint to the ligaments that tie into this bone. And if you took the muscle and untied it from the bone here and tied it to the bone here, suddenly your arm would be like this, and you would be able to do this, because that's all the contraction your muscle can do. That's all you can do. So, in order to get a lot more work out of this arm than just this, the organizer of the arm, in his wisdom, attached the ligaments here, so that when this muscle does all the contracting it can do, it's pulling on here. But look how much work is getting done out there at the end of your fingers. So it's all about how you organize the assets that you have. But you have to have the right assets. If you have no muscle, you have no joint, you have no bone, you have no ligaments, you have nothing, it won't work. And that's what Paul is saying here in verse 6 when he says, circumcision doesn't have the basic ingredients required. Uncircumcision doesn't have the basic ingredients required. Faith is the only system that has the basic ingredients that are required. That's what he's arguing. So he chooses his words on that basis. What Paul is doing is he's focusing on the inherent nature, the inherent resources of the varied approaches. And that means he's looking at whether or not the systems, the entire systems, have the inherent resources necessary to accomplish the task of being accepted by God so that life can be good. Inherent things. That's why it means anything or doesn't mean anything is really is off the wall. It means it can't work. It won't produce. It accomplishes nothing. Circumcision accomplishes nothing. Uncircumcision accomplishes nothing. Faith accomplishes everything. But that means then that Paul is dismissing an entire continuum. If you put circumcision on this end of a line, and you draw the line down to the opposite, and you put uncircumcision down here, that's called a continuum. And from this to this, Paul is saying, none of this works. On this end of the continuum, where we have circumcision, the fundamental issues have to do with divine revelation and human commitment to obedience. Those are the two basic things that have to do with whether or not the resources are going to work. You have divine revelation and the Mosaic law, and you have the determination of the Jewish will to say, I'm going to keep it. And Paul says, forget it. It isn't going to happen. It's not that the revelation is at fault, but the determination is too weak. It can't carry it. It's not going to work. On this end of the continuum, you have what we would call ignorance, because there's no divine revelation, so they don't know enough. And you have a totally different kind of commitment to action. And because uncircumcision's basic issue is ignorance in reaction, where something comes up and you don't know how to deal with it, so you just deal with it. That's the Gentile. The Jewish thing would say, well, God has said this. We know how to deal with this. And then they would try. The Gentiles who have no revelation would say, I don't know what to do here. I have no clue as to what to do here. But life's continuing to press and I've got to do something. So this is what I'm going to do. Blow up in his face. Neither one of these things will work. The Jew says, do what God tells you. And the Gentile says, just do the best you can. But doing the best you can will never work. the universe is way too complicated. You're not smart enough to be able to handle it. So whatever scenario is tossed in your face, just write it down. You're going to blow it. Circumcision won't work. Uncircumcision will not work. There is nothing on the line between the two that can work. Nothing has the elements that are necessary. Paul's alternative is faith, energized by love. Now this is where everything gets real touchy. Because at the top of Paul's heap here, in terms of what will work, is the word faith. And that raises the issue of whether or not the Galatians understand what faith is. And we've talked this faith thing to death on many occasions about many approaches, but the fact is, talking about faith is talking about a very profound concept. And so, in my penchant for not being able to handle broad concepts and many details, that all scares me to death. I just look for a bottom line. So, my understanding of faith at the bottom line is that at its core, faith is a passive state in which the one exercising it expects God to take action. You stop and think about it. When Jesus said that if you had faith as a grain of mustard seed, you could say this mountain be plucked up and cast into the sea, and the mountain would be cast into the sea. When Jesus said that, he was saying that faith as a grain of mustard seed posits results that only God can achieve on the basis of a power that only God has. Faith doesn't move that mountain into the sea. Faith doesn't have the capacity. There's no power there. There's nothing that can cause that mountain to pluck up and splash. The only thing that can cause that to happen is for God to exercise a power that only He really has. Now, you know, these days we tend to blow up the power of man. We say, well, you know, we could probably deflect a meteor that was headed for the earth if we could just shoot an atomic bomb and hit it at the right place and fragment it into all these, and it would be our powerful use of atomic energy to save the planet and all. I mean, these scenarios come up. But the fact is, bottom line, Jesus used the grain of mustard seed concept to force us to think in terms of faith, not as a power in and of itself. We make this huge mistake when we say prayer changes things. No, God changes things. Your conversation with Him may be a catalyst, but the power is not in the catalyst. It's in the God. Moving the mountain is not in the faith. It's in the God who responds to the faith. So that if you can get God to respond to your confidence, then it will be done. And if you can't get Him to respond to your confidence, then your confidence is misplaced and it won't be done. So, it should be then beyond obvious, at least in my eyes, that faith is an attitude that includes the power of God as He acts on the behalf of those who have no power. Powerlessness is faced by confidence in somebody who does have power. And Jesus never encourages anybody to have any confidence in their own power. He does not. When we have confidence in our ability, we're not exercising biblical faith. We're exercising a perversion of faith. In the Bible, faith is a passive state where you expect God to do something. So, it should be then clear that Paul has moved the issues of inherent capacity, verse 6, circumcision, uncircumcision, no inherent capacities to accomplish the task. They cannot do it. It's got to be clear that Paul has moved the issue of inherent capacity out of the realm of man into the realm of God so that He is the omnipotent executor of power and He will exercise that power when He sees the expectation of his hopeless, helpless child who is dependent on him to do something that the child cannot do. That's Jesus' statement about if you have faith as a grain of mustard seed. When you go to Romans chapter 4, verse 21, Paul seems to say that the greatest lesson that Abraham ever learned was what? You know that one. The one who makes the promise is the one who's supposed to keep it. In other words, if God said this would be the case, Abraham's response was, then God's going to have to make it happen. The classic Abrahamic illustration is the conception and birth of Isaac. It was postponed by God for 100 years. Not really. I mean, he didn't make the promise to Abraham when he was first born. But the whole idea of God waiting until Abraham was 99 and Sarah was 89 and waiting till there's no hope here of a son ever being conceived or born, absolutely, it's beyond the realm of even human. I mean, nobody expects this is going to happen. It's not going to happen if there's anything human in it. So God waits until there cannot be anything human in it. And then he says to both Abraham and Sarah, in a convincing scenario, when the time comes around next year, you're going to have a son. And when the time comes around next year, they have a son. That's God acting on the behalf of those who cannot act for themselves. They're powerless in the situation. And their powerlessness was in the area of their greatest desire. Abraham wanted a son more than anything, but he couldn't make it happen. Paul says in Romans 4:21, it was Abraham's fully developed conviction that what God promises up to him to accomplish. So, if God made a promise, up to him to keep it. What am I supposed to do in the face of that? I'm supposed to depend on him to do it because I'm transferring the inherent issue of whether it can be done, whether the resources are there. I'm transferring that completely out of my realm and putting it in his. That's why the question was raised when Sarah laughed and God asked that very well-known question. Is anything too hard for Yahweh? Can omnipotence actually handle the thing that's faced here? So Abraham's greatest learned lesson was learning how to expect God to do what he said he'd do without compromising that whole process by inserting his own abilities or the wisdom of anybody else, including his wife. He wasn't supposed to listen to any kind of plan that could cause him to be able to do this. It wasn't up to him to do it. He didn't make the promise to God. He got the promise from God. Now, this is where the real issue then gets down to the rubber meeting the road, because this does not rule out human action. It does not rule out human behavior, simply because God is committed to a principle called sharing his life. In order to participate in the experience called life, you have to share with God what is his. In his presence is fullness of joy. That's the essence of eternal life. If you want to experience that, you're going to have to share it with him, because he's willing to share it. And you can participate by sharing what is his. A big part of God sharing his life is allowing other people to do things cooperatively with him, so that they are involved in accomplishing the will of God. God says, you will have no greater joy than being able to be involved with me in the accomplishment of the things that I've decreed are going to be. That means then that intermediate agents are part of God's plan. He's a master at including others. And that means then that when he makes a promise, he'll keep it, and he very may well use other people to keep it. He may not, but he very well may. We see this across the board in all of creation. For example, God's our healer. The Bible says that. But I think it's dead wrong to refuse to go to any kind of medical help or go for any kind of medical help just because God's your healer. Yeah, God's your healer. And if a doctor can prescribe something that causes your body to get well, God still made your body well. It's just that he used the doctor and the prescription to accomplish that. That's his character. He shares what he wants to be done with others so that they can be included in the whole process. He lets others be involved with him. He's the ultimate user of intermediate agents for the joy of the agents who cooperate with him and to the frustration of those who refuse to. He still gets his will done. He just frustrates the dickens out of those that don't want that to be done, and yet they end up being the ones who cause it to be done. The issue, however, for faith is that the human behavior, the human actions are never to be allowed to be the essential ingredient. God's wisdom, God's use of power, his willingness to allow others to be involved, either by permission or direct infusion of power, God's the one who accomplishes his objectives by his power, his wisdom, and his selective permissions of other people's use of his power. Every creature born is given a dispensation of power by God, and he allows them a certain amount of freedom in the exercise of it, but never without his oversight and control, so that if they start this domino roll running and it's going to frustrate the will of God, he just cuts it off. He's perfectly free to do that. And he does do it. So, it doesn't rule out human involvement, but it does rule out human roots. Because the task, the agenda, those things are in view, and man doesn't decide what's important or how to make it work. God says this is important, this is what's going to be, this is the nature of promise. I promise this will be. Man doesn't decide the agenda, and he doesn't decide the method. He just cooperates with God or resists him in the process of the outworking. So men can never be seen as the root of the thing. This is what bothers me so much about the concept of what I'm now calling sanctificational legalism, where justification's by grace through faith alone, but your Christian life's kind of obedience and you doing and, you know, so on. When you move the human element into the mix, you have just moved God out of it. Because everywhere in the scripture that faith is being addressed, the issue is whether God's going to use his power to accomplish what he promised or not. Mountains don't move by human power. There's nothing in the human that makes the mountain move. It's the attitude of dependence in powerlessness that causes God to act. That's what makes the mountain move. So, in the systems, there are three. Circumcision, uncircumcision, neither one of those systems will work. They lack the fundamental ingredients. Faith is a system that works because, primarily because, it consists of a powerless dependence upon God to infuse the situation with his resources, his essential attributes. And that will never happen except as the verse ends, energized through love. Faith is an operational word. It's a methodological word. It has to do with how the methods, what method's going to be used. But love is the thing that decides whether the task is legitimate. The reason that no mountain has ever been plucked up and cast into the sea by a human spoken word, I mean, it's never happened. Jesus said, if you have faith as a grain of mustard seed, you could do this. Obviously, nobody has ever had faith as a grain of mustard seed in regard to a mountain being plucked up and cast in the sea. It's never happened. If it had ever happened, it would have been recorded in history, and we'd read about it, just like Jonah being swallowed by a big fish. It's never happened. Why not? Didn't anybody ever have a mustard seed worth of faith in that direction? The answer is no. Well, why not? because it's not a valuable action. Moving that mountain into the sea is not considered by God to be a valuable thing. You don't apply the power of God to worthless activities. That's a worthless activity. Jesus didn't say that it was an important thing. He just said if you have the faith, it can be done. He's emphasizing the power of God in response to powerless confidence, but he's not addressing whether it will be done. Paul is addressing in verse 6 whether it will be done. And the issue that decides whether a thing will be done is the love that is driving the agenda. Love decides whether a task is worth pursuing. And if it is, it will be done. And it'll be done especially for those who are powerless in the pursuit of it, but dependent and confident in God. It will be done. It's a powerful thing. Because God says, yeah, this is important. But if God says, no, that's not important, forget it. You may be able to manipulate, you may be able to apply your dispensation of power to certain things, and you may make a facsimile, something that's almost quite, it's not the same thing, but it's like it, a facsimile. You may be able to create a facsimile of a mountain being cast into the sea, but you'll never cast a mountain into the sea. It isn't going to happen unless God says, yep, that's valuable. And that's the conundrum we face when we go to God in our powerless prayer, in our ignorance of His love. We say, I want this to happen. And God sees the whole thing and says, that's not going to happen. Or we say, I don't want that to happen. And God looks at it and says, it's going to happen. Or we say, I want this to happen. And God says, I want it to happen too. Bang! It happens. Faith energized by love simply means that anything that fits the underlying character of love in the eyes of the one whose omni-wisdom decrees what's valuable, he will apply his power to accomplish that task, and he will do it particularly in the eyes and hearts of men who are looking for that to be done, but they can't make it happen, so they call upon him to do it. And he does. I believe that that's what the issue in verse 16 is. Paul is making a definitive categorical declaration about what will actually cause God to move into action to accomplish a thing. And it's outside of the entire universe of human effort or lack thereof. Circumcision or uncircumcision, those are a universe that has been rejected by Paul. They don't have the resources necessary. Faith in God has the issues of the resources necessary. That'll work. But it only works when it's energized by the love of God. And the biggest question that we face in our lives is, well, is this important to God or not? Sometimes we can read in the Bible that God says, yeah, that's important. And sometimes the Bible just doesn't have anything to say about it. And so we don't know. So what are we supposed to do? Well, we're free to ask him to do whatever we want him to do, but we're not free to demand that he do it. The agenda is a love-driven thing, and we're not free to enforce our agenda. We're only free to ask God to do things in our powerless state. If he considers it important, it'll be done. If he doesn't, we say, okay. Not my will, but yours be done. And it doesn't have to be as crucial as facing Calvary. It can be a small thing. But nonetheless, the issue is, if this is something within your plan, then this is what I want you to do, God. And he either does it or he doesn't. Because it is energized by this system called love that says this is important and that's not, this is and that's not, this is and that's not. And that's a constant thing in our experience. I personally have come to the conclusion, the very difficult conclusion in the minds and hearts of most of us as human beings, but nonetheless, I've come to the conclusion that a lot of times the thing that we want so badly for God to do, He will not do because We want it so badly that we have imposed our agenda on his love, and he says, that's idolatry, you can't do that, and I'm not going to help you with it. So that a lot of the times, the very thing we're asking God to do is the very thing he can't do, because we're insisting that he do it. We're forcing the agenda, if we can. And I really do believe that a lot of the things that happen to us that hurt us the worst, because it contradicts our values, we say, I had to have this. I know all of you have heard of people who have said, if God doesn't do this, then I'm not going to have anything else to do with God. Well, what is that? That's an expression of the depravity of man, where he says, this is more important to me than the will of God. This is more important to me than God. And if God's not going to cooperate, then I'm not going to have anything to do with him. Well, he's not going to cooperate, given that attitude. Unless he does it by grace. He may. Even when our agenda's completely screwball, he may go ahead and do what we ask, but that's a dangerous thing for him to reinforce our selfishness. When God told Abraham, take your son upon the mountain and offer him there as a sacrifice, Abraham could have said, sorry, God, that's off the wall. That's off the agenda. It ain't going to happen. I'm not taking my son up there. I waited too long to get him. You gave him to me. You promised him to me. And you can't take him away. So just forget it. He could have said all of that. But he didn't. He saddled his donkey. He got his firewood and he took off for the mountain. Because he had learned to be the friend of God. Being God's friend means, if he wants us, that's what he gets. You want my son? You got my son. That's all I had planned to say. In fact, it's a little more than I planned.